Hello and welcome to the Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell of charliejewell.com.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl of chickflix.net.
Hannah, I think tonight is going to be a first. Something that's never, ever, ever happened on Cinema Clash before. And we've been doing this for almost 2 years. I think of the four movies we're going to talk about, I don't know all of your views yet, but I think I liked each one of them more than you did. Each one of them.
I took a sneak peek at your reviews, and I would say that's probably true.
That's never happened before, because I usually am far more critical about certain things than you, and you're like, it's fine, it's okay. But no, I think tonight, we are in for a rare treat.
This for you is like a 3-star-plus kind of week.
Nothing was actually below 3 stars.
That's amazing. For me.
But the wine, we went back to red, and we shouldn't have, because it's still, global warming is still sitting on top of D.C. right
still
now.
Still 110 degrees outside.
But we went back to red from rosé, because there's really only so much rosé you can drink. And Hannah, see if you can match this wine with a film.
Okay, so the wine is called Hope's End.
And run away to the dark side. Run away to a place called Port Misery.
I suppose it could work for a couple of them, but I suspect maybe you did it to go with the very first film we're going to talk about, Dunkirk?
You're absolutely right. It fits exactly with Dunkirk, because if you are sitting on a beach looking at 26 miles of water in front of you that you cannot swim across, that boats cannot come and pick you up at, the German army is right behind you as their planes dive bomb you and everyone is dying, Hope's End.
Okay, I'll let you have that one.
Dunkirk is directed by Christopher Nolan. We're talking the man who does 2.5-hour marathon Batman films and Memento and Inception and Interstellar. The man's got a pedigree.
Yes.
And here he comes with, in my opinion, the year's first 4-star film and the best film of the year so far. It will be remembered come Best Picture time. Dunkirk is tense. It's fascinating. It's realistic. I just saw Terrence Malick tweet about it. He said, Dunkirk is BS. There's no voiceover.
Oh, wait a minute. Yes. It's a total Terrence Malick trick.
Well, I think this is a very straightforward film. You know, there's not a lot of dialogue because he's telling you the story through action.
Yeah.
In three separate battle spaces, which we'll get to. But after the movie was over, and it's a relatively quick film because there's only so much intensity, Chris Nolan says, the human body can take. You said, I felt it was obscure. And I was like, wait a minute.
Obtuse
is Terrence Malick's The Thin Red Line, when you have soldiers asking, what is life? No one here asked, what is life?
No, and maybe obtuse probably was not the best word. It was more, it's abstract, it's non-linear, it's very short on narration, on dialogue. So I think that a lot of people, it's important that you go into this film. You need to know the backstory. You need to actually know what occurred.
They had words up on screen.
They had words up on screen for the first 30 seconds where you get your little, you know, 1940, 300,000 troops are on this beach. So you get some setup, but I still think that as an experience, you're going to get more out of it the more informed you are about the events of what happened with the evacuation of Dunkirk during World War II.
Did you understand why it's nonlinear? Why it had to be?
No.
So I mentioned the three different battle spaces. You have the young kids, the 18-year-old privates on the beach, and they're stuck. And they're there for a week. The ships cannot get to them. It's too shallow. They can't dock on the beach. And even those who try get torpedoed by German U-boats. They just can't get to them. On the other side, there are these what they call little ships. The civilians who own their little pleasure yachts, who get conscripted by the British Navy, who in one day, all as an armada, sail over to try and pick up as many troops as they can. That's in one day. Then you have the aircraft overhead. They can only fly an hour sortie at a time because they, you know, the Spitfires had limited fuel. So that's why it was nonlinear. You're telling a week story, a day story, and an hour story.
But you have to know all of that going in, otherwise it's very difficult to track.
Because I notice sometimes you see the consequences of an action, like a ship is sunk, and in the next scene, the ship is fine, in fact, and you're like, ooh, I see what you did there.
See, I didn't see what they did there. It took me a minute, and I was like, wait a minute, is that the same guy we just saw in this other scenario? And to me, the biggest issue I had was that there were several young, white, dark-haired guys who all looked the same when they had dirt on their faces or oil on their faces from whatever mishap they happened to be in. I failed to tell them apart. It took me a while, and I was like, wait, which person is that? And so there's one small narrative that I felt like you can really follow in this film, and that's the part where you have our old buddy Mark Rylance as...
otherwise we'll get told again. Mark Rylance.
As one of the... as a civilian who is one of those people taking their pleasure boat out across the ocean to pick up some troops. And so there's a story with him and his son and a family friend who joins them on this this little mission. That's the only story out of this entire, you know, film that had all these different kind of interwoven pieces. That's the only narrative that I felt I was able to track.
I will not disagree with you that it is challenging sometimes to separate guys, especially the soldiers on the beach. They all look alike.
Except for Harry Styles.
And I didn't realize that was Harry Styles until the credits. And since they all look alike, these mostly are first-time actors, especially those three main kids on the beach. The main one we were watching is his first film. His name's Finn Whitehead. But I want to defend it. You get lost a little bit. You don't know who's who, especially when they're all dirty. Because the fog of war. War is dirty, war is messy, war is confusing, things get stuck in the mud. And brilliant. If everyone had a clean face the whole time and I recognized Tom Cruise, it wouldn't be as effective, because thank you for pointing out the reality of war sometimes. And yes, Mark Rylance was very easy to keep track of, and that was a very good third of the film. I think my favorite part of the film was in the aircraft. That was Tom Hardy, a very famous actor, now nominated for an Academy Award for The Revenant. He was Mad Max.
Mm-hmm. I like Tom Hardy.
It's hard. You didn't see his face the whole time because it was
hardly at all.
He was on oxygen, but he has some heavy lifting to do. All that acting through a mask, which I guess he did as Bane as well.
But there were a couple of pilots acting through masks, and there were times where it's like, which one is that? And which pilot gets shot down, and who's out in the water, and who's being rescued, and who has been rescued. And because it's nonlinear, that made it even more difficult to sometimes be able to tell certain characters apart. And so I get what you're coming from. I do think this is it's a cinematic experience that if you see it on as big a screen as possible to have this immersive experience, you're going to like the experience even if you don't particularly like the movie. And that's how I felt about it, is I was not on that bandwagon of this being a masterpiece, but I appreciated the fact that it's, you know, shot in this 70 millimeter and IMAX, and is designed to be on this giant screen and bring you in. And I think this is one of those films that will never ever translate. If anyone thinks that they can wait till award season and watch this on Netflix on a little TV or even a 42 inch or a 50 inch, they're not going to get it. I think they're going to tune out of this film.
He shot it on film. In this digital age, he shot it on IMAX and 70 millimeter film. And the biggest example I want to point out to you of why you need to see it in a theater on a big screen. Do you remember the overhead long shot of the beach? You see the whole beach, mm-hmm. and you see all these lines of soldiers. On the screen, they look like people. If it was on your TV, they would look like ants.
Yeah. Well, and what's interesting is I just happened to catch today, so Slate.com did a fascinating... This film is available in 6 different formats across all these theaters. So they break it down, and they have an explainer of, if you watch it on IMAX, this is how much screen you're going to see, this is what it's going to look like. If you end up seeing it on some traditional 35 millimeter screen, this is how it's going to look. If you see it in IMAX 70 millimeter, I mean, it was fascinating. And so you actually can get the different perspectives, and this absolute explainer for folks like me who aren't always aware of these format differences. It was a very interesting way to look at it, so that you understand really what you'd be missing if you don't see it on a huge screen.
I think it is a masterpiece. I feel it. I didn't realize it until some way into the film. I clenched. I was clenched up. I was tense. that stopwatch in the background and Hans Zimmer's score, which is a bunch of strings and bass and like groaning metal underneath. It's a tense film, and man, it had me from beginning to end.
I mean, it's a cinematic composition. It really is a musical score with a movie behind it versus when you're used to seeing a film that's scored to match the dialogue and the action that's going on. This felt way more integrated. It's a score first, and with these visuals, with these amazing visuals accompanying it, and it has these crescendos, and in the end, you know, it ends with this great flourish, just like so it's more like a musical masterpiece. And so I get all that, but I feel that I feel like the expectations for a lot of people going into this movie, they will hear that it's a masterpiece, it's a must-see, and it's brilliant filmmaking. But if you are the type of person who likes a traditional narrative, you're not going to understand this film if you do not go in with some backstory already in place and prepared for understanding what makes it so different and why it's being recognized for its uniqueness. But it's not a traditional war movie that a lot of people are used to seeing.
It's not, and I wonder if that's the reason why I liked it so much. I didn't need all the dialogue to watch what was going on. I understood it.
Yeah, but I think you come at it from a slightly different perspective.
Well, I knew a lot more that was going on. Yes. I was judging airplane angle of right. attack in there. But
yeah, where I'm going, which dude is that?
So. Our next film is, it's a long title, it's kind of a choppy title, Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets. Luc Besson, the man who in 94 wowed us with The Professional, 97 wowed us with The Fifth Element, and then disappeared for a while in a bunch of crap, except for The First Taken. He did The First Taken, then he wrote Taken 2 and Taken 3, and he had a lot of bad movies in there. But he's back, a comic book adaptation of a comic book I'd never heard of, Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets. Hannah, I don't do summer blockbusters. I just don't care.
Really?
I usually don't. And sometimes I analyze movies too hard, and I forget to have fun. I forget that people go to the movies to have fun, have a good time.
I'm sorry, can you repeat that, please?
I'm not kidding. And I had...
I'm sorry, Charlie. You have to repeat that for me.
People sometimes go to the movies to have a good time.
You know, somebody that sometimes talks to you weekly in a podcast brings that up quite often and is poo-pooed for it.
Well, I had so much fun watching Valerian. I just had a grin on my face. It's this sci-fi action thriller with the two leads flirting with one another and crazy-looking creatures and spaceships. What a blast. I haven't had this much fun since the first Guardians of the Galaxy, Hannah. Tell me you had as much fun as I did.
I didn't. I mean, certainly you can't say that this was more fun than Guardians of the Galaxy 2 that we saw a few months ago.
No, I like it a little bit better than that.
See, I think you're actually in quite the minority.
I am in the minority on this
film. You are totally in the minority. I mean, I'm not nearly as brutal about this film as some of the reviews I've seen, because some people are really tearing it to pieces on multiple levels. To me, it was like watching one of those episodes of Star Trek or Next Generation where it's aliens interact, all these different species of aliens all interacting and hanging out at the club and, partying and then having conflict and this mishmash of alien creatures. And so to me, it really was a fairly standard space alien movie. So I didn't not like it, but I definitely did not feel like it rose to the level of anything particularly memorable for me.
I didn't think there was anything standard about it. I thought it was unique and original. You just don't see this all the time on such a grand scale. I mean, this is a galaxy on the scale of like Star Wars. That's how big it is.
Visually, it's great. I don't argue with you that it, from a visual perspective, it's a fun watch. But it's a hot mess in the middle.
They are having almost too much fun to really care about that plot, which is, the plot's like a whodunit mystery. A species went missing, a planet got destroyed, who was on the planet and who did it? Okay, you kind of know who did it, because the villain overacts like the villain. Yeah. And so, okay, It's not about the plot, who did it. It's about the leads. I want to talk about the leads. Major Valerian, played by Dane DeHaan. Dane DeHaan, remember from this year, A Cure for Wellness.
A Cure for Wellness.
He was the goblin guy in The Amazing Spider-Man.
Oh, yeah.
In that first remake. He was in Chronicle. Dane DeHaan is not your typical superhero action man, which is, he's like a kid, but he's like this like cocky kid. He's this cocky kid.
He's too cocky of a kid and seems too much of a kid to be playing like a captain or a major.
But maybe they do that in the 28th century. Yeah.
But that was my issue with both leads, is that they seemed so young. And here they are, these top-notch agents in their field who are sent on these missions, and they are. They have this flirtation going on. But I didn't feel like the development of that tracked all that well. They're cute. They're cute together, and they're kind of fun to watch in certain aspects of this film. But they seem too young to me from the get-go. I thought, wow, it's like high school kids. And I mean, I like Dane DeHaan. He's very recognizable. Like, I knew immediately when I saw his eyes that he reminded me. I'm like, what did I just see him in? And it was that
weird movie with the eels.
that disgusting, weird movie that nobody else saw other than maybe John Armstrong and Christian.
I really like that movie. That was a good movie. And you. Christian Hammaker, probably. Hammaker. I always butchered his name. Gosh. Loved that movie.
Yeah. So there are some people who absolutely had loved A Cure for Wellness. I like this one way better than that. But I did think that it's, for the most part, it went on way too long.
It was a long movie.
It's way too long. This did need to be. And then you had these sort of minor subplots and characters that were thrown in. Ethan Hawke is in it for like a minute.
He's a pimp.
As a pimp, as like an intergalactic pimp.
And whose pimp is he?
Rihanna! So then you have the gorgeous Rihanna. I mean, you cannot deny that that woman is just like disgustingly flawless looking. And there's this fun little sequence of costume changes and things that she goes through doing her little pole dance and things. But I read one review just slammed that performance.
Really? I loved that performance.
And I thought she was fine. But, I mean, it was just thrown in. I felt like there was, like, the stuff on the cutting room floor, and that they realized that the scene in this little Paradise Alley where they, I don't know, where the lead was going in to look for some bad dude. And that went on too long. And yet, they felt like we have Rihanna and we have Ethan Hawke, and so we need to jam this in here. And there were just too many things going on in the middle, and it took you away.
I recognize Bassan's problem. There is so much of this galaxy he wants you to see. So much of this Alpha Station, which is the International Space Station built up into the City of a Thousand Planets, that he wants you to see and show you and reveal to you. And I see his problem. And when Rihanna becomes a 5 to 10 minute sideshow, you can see just how much stuff he's throwing in there. But anyone who goes to see Valerian, which is actually named after Dane DeHaan's character, isn't going to remember Dane DeHaan. They're going to remember Cara Delevingne.
Right.
Cara Delevingne is Sergeant Loreline, the second half of the duo of the agent superhero team that Valerian's in love with. He spends the whole movie saying, I love you, be with me. And she's like, dude, I know your list of conquests. Cara Delevingne, she's a model by trade. Mm-hmm. She is a very, very famous model. She's an international supermodel. She had the misfortune of being cast as the Enchantress in Suicide Squad, a terrible character and a not good performance. She was widely mocked for her performance. And I don't know how much of that was her or how much of that was the character.
Whole movie sucked.
She was also in Paper Towns, which was a knockoff Fault in Our Stars.
That's right.
But here, breakout star. People are going to remember Cara Delevingne here. She holds her own. It's a giant leap forward for her. She did very, very good. I was very impressed with her.
I like them both. I do think this movie propels her certainly beyond Suicide Squad, because that was terrible. And she has a striking look, so I remembered her from Paper Towns. Even though that film itself, nobody remembers Paper Towns. I remember not hating Paper Towns. And she was recognizable to me then, too. She just has that. And I think the problem with Enchantress is she was unrecognizable that one.
That was just a bad character.
Yeah, it was a bad character. So I agree that she's good. They're cute. It's relatively fun. But do I put it anywhere aside from a visually stellar or interstellar type of experience? I would not put this above Guardians of the Galaxy 2 at all. And to me, if you like these alien space movies, then sure, there's nothing wrong with going to see this one. It's based on a comic book that I'd never heard of. And so I didn't know about the comics, but I guess if you know, if you're familiar with these comics and you like, there's a lot of virtual reality type stuff in this film. And so it just throws everything at you.
The barometer is the fifth element. If you remember 1997's The Fifth Element with Bruce Willis and Lilu and Chris Tucker, which really put him on the map, then you're going to love this film. There's such a strong Fifth Element vibe in this movie. And the beginning is one of the best beginnings I've ever seen in a sci-fi film. Major Tom, David Bowie.
I love that.
And it's got, they keep adding, the people keep arriving at the space station. What a phenomenal start.
I did love the opening. I was all into it with the open. And I was with it for the romance to some degree. But in the end, to me, it felt like a really strong extended episode of any of Deep Space Nine, Star Trek, any of those TV shows. I felt like I had seen a lot of aspects of these stories thrown in, and so I just think you are potentially in the minority.
Not even potentially.
And we know that the next film we're going to talk about has a higher Rotten Tomatoes rating than Valerian.
Well, that's how rare this episode of the Cinema Clash is. I am usually the one tearing apart summer blockbusters and tentpole movies, and I'm defending this one hardcore, and I love it.
I'm not rejecting it, but I am certainly nowhere near over the moon with it as far as you are.
All right, you mentioned our next film, and our next film is a reminder. Women can be just as disgusting and raunchy and foul-mouthed as men. We knew they could be from Bridesmaids. We've seen it. But for every Bridesmaids, there are 14 hangover films to get till you get your next Bridesmaids. And this is the next Bridesmaids. These women are disgusting.
They're
hilarious. I laughed so big. And Hannah, there's a reason I did. It's because of the audience we saw it with. If I was on my couch watching this on Netflix, I would have chuckled twice.
Yeah.
I howled in the movie because the audience, hundreds of women around us.
And men.
Lost
you had the guy their behind
minds.
You. You had a guy behind you who was doing color commentary and cracking up throughout this film. So
it's a foursome. So when you have a foursome, you're going to have the party animal, the straight-laced woman, the successful one, and the fourth one who doesn't quite fit.
That's right.
By far my favorite and everyone's favorite, and the what Bridesmaids did for Melissa McCarthy, Girls Trip will do for Tiffany Haddish. What did you think about Tiffany Haddish?
Tiffany Haddish is this film's secret weapon. She is the scene stealer throughout. She's the unapologetic party animal of this group. The physical comedy that she is involved in is just hysterical. And so she's just that one that you kind of rely on to remind you that you are watching a intentionally raunchy physical comedy. It's a girls reunion film. So it's like these four women, they knew each other in college. They were best buddies. They were Flossie's posse.
The Flossie posse.
And here they're getting back together again. It's been a few years. They're kind of estranged. And
as friends do, they drifted apart.
They drifted apart, and then they have this opportunity to reconnect by going to the annual Essence Festival in New Orleans. And of course, anybody who's ever gone to party in New Orleans knows that place is where you can absolutely get debaucheried and be all out. So it's fun. It's funny. It's predictable and formulaic by the end. But it's okay because you've had a fun time getting there. And so I think their only mistake will be if they end up trying too hard to market it to the African-American community, because we know the screening that we saw it at was probably 90% African-American, and they all loved it and hooted and hollered. And I don't want them to market this because I think it that way, because I think it's got mainstream appeal.
Oh, it certainly does.
It has tons of mainstream appeal. And so for the same way and reasons that, Rough Night apparently was, I missed it, thank goodness, because apparently it was a bomb with Scarlett Johansson a few weeks ago. And so this one, I think, is the one that everyone who maybe went to see Rough Night was hoping to see something like this instead of really good, funny women ensemble comedy. Hopefully they won't have been spoiled by having a bad experience with Rough Night, and they will still try and go see this one.
Girls' Night. You got me thinking of Girls' Night. Girls' Trip is directed by Malcolm D. Lee. He directed a cult classic, which is already a cult classic, and beloved film, Undercover Brother. Hysterical movie. I love that movie. He also did the two best man films, which is Girls' Trip, but tamer, and it's for men.
And Barbershop, the next cut, which was
Barbershop,
very good.
It was like Barbershop 3.
Mm-hmm.
What Girls' Trip has going for it, its number one thing, is it moves. It moves so mm-hmm. fast. When something doesn't work, and a lot doesn't work, they will get on a joke riff that just falls flat on its face. You know, 30 seconds later, something's gonna come behind it and work. When they make fun of Jada Pinkett Smith, the straight-laced character, for dressing, I don't know, like modestly in Latin American clothing, that doesn't work.
Right.
But when they overdose on absinthe and start violating furniture, that works. When the setup is too hard, but when they end up dousing the crowd in something twice, I died.
That you could not. There is a scene that we can't spoil, but
it's in the preview. I don't want to spoil it.
But when it happens, you're like, oh no.
Yeah.
And then they do it again.
They did it twice.
and same with the grapefruit.
Great. If grapefruiting makes a crossover, makes it into pop culture, this movie has won.
Oh.
And people start talking about grapefruiting.
Everyone will if they see this film.
Did you notice it's really, really playing to its intended audience?
Mm-hmm.
Our intended audience can be rebellious, especially when it comes to humor. They can be very loud and very rebellious, but they're very religious. And the girls take time to get down on their knees and pray.
Oh, right.
The prayer goes sideways because they start wishing to be impregnated by rich men. But they're praying nonetheless. And so this movie knows what it's doing. It's a little smart. And it's got four writers. And the main one, I noticed, was Kenya Barris, who created Black-ish.
Oh. Well, and I do think, Queen Latifah is probably the one who brings the biggest star power. But she's probably of the four... I would say she and Jada Pinkett Smith are the biggest names, and they're probably the weakest characters.
Well, I noticed Queen Latifah took one for the team. She's not in it for the laughs. You don't laugh at her, and she doesn't get the biggest. She doesn't have sex with someone that she's not supposed to, or do something inappropriate that she's not supposed to. Really, she does the heavy lifting. She's got the more dramatic. Regina Hall has she's the lead character. She has the most dramatic arc. But Queen Latifah really took one for the team. Someone in the group has to be the sober one. The I'm going to hold it together and be there for my girls one. And that was Queen Latifah. But if you remember Set It Off back in the 90s with Queen Latifah and Jada Pinkett Smith, watch out for the nod. That brought the house down.
And it's, it's a little of everything. You got your dancing, your drinking, a lot of girls brawling. There are a lot of cat fights in this film. But then it takes you to a sweet moment. Like, the culmination of this story is something that I think a lot of women, especially with gal pals that they've lost touch with, can really identify with. This film, though, had no business being more than 2 hours.
It was long. It was a little over 2 hours.
Way too long. This is a film that should have been, they should have figured out a way to make it under 100 minutes.
And you knew how it was going to end. You knew there was going to be a big speech. You knew it was going to be in the convention. Was going to come clean. You knew what was going to happen.
You knew exactly how it was going to end. And so this is just not a 2+ hour film. And I think it's going to suffer when it gets chopped up for something like the movie, for an airplane film or something. And that's a shame because it should not be that long. But in the end, it was fun. People came out. They were happy.
Yeah. And it was infectious. They were grinning ear to ear in an effective. This is one of those. This is a pure example of how audience impacts how the reception of a film. I did not want to go. It's not my movie. And I had a blast.
Yeah. And so, Girls' Trip can mean many different things.
Well, the punctuation is missing.
On
purpose. You see what they're doing.
Yes. So, because you can read it as it's a girl's trip. It's girls tripping. It's going on a hallucinogenic trip. And then it's also a girl's trip. They make mistakes. They find their way back. They fix things. So it's, you know, it's an interesting concept.
It works. It's just a funny movie.
It works. It works. It's fun. It's funny. It's, I don't think it will become a classic, but people will enjoy it.
It's no undercover brother.
You will enjoy it in the moment, and the physical comedy is great, but it is absolutely R. It is a hard R.
I guarantee
film.
You we'll see a sequel to this film.
I suspect we will, but it made me want to just get in touch with all my gal pals from college and plan our next reunion, which we actually have planned for when Top Gun 2 comes out.
Oh, Lord.
But so I totally identified with that concept and getting together with your posse and having fun.
All right, well, we couldn't have a Cinema Clash episode without an out there movie. Usually it's French, but this one, this time, it's still foreign, and it's in Thai. It's called Popeye, but it's not like Popeye, P-O-P-E-Y-E, like the cartoon character you know. It's two words, Popeye, A-Y-E.
Why?
I don't know, because it's in Thai.
No, I honestly think because in the little, what you call it, when it's subtitled, Popeye is spelled P-O-P-E-Y-E. And so I think that they had to change the spelling because
they didn't have rights.
I think they didn't have rights because it is spelled Popeye when they refer to that animal. Anyway, I'm sorry. I digress.
Popeye won an award at Sundance. It won the screenwriting award. And I can see why. It's by a first-time feature film director, Kirsten Tam. She's Singaporean. And she broke rules of what you're not supposed to do on your first feature film. Your first feature film, you're not supposed to do it in a foreign country. She did. She went to Thailand to film it. You're not supposed to have a big animal in it. What big animal is Popeye?
He's a big old elephant.
It's a road trip movie. It's a road trip movie with a man and his elephant. The man is...
Yeah.
It's described as a midlife crisis, but I don't think it is.
Yeah.
The theme is the world has moved on, and it's left kind of his generation behind. The youngsters at the office say, you know what? We're better with clients. How about you just stay out of this meeting? He's an architect, and the building he's known for that he built 30 years ago is getting torn down. And that is a metaphor.
Yeah.
So he stumbles into this elephant that he remembers from childhood. He has a connection to this elephant, and he's like, you know what? I'm going to do the right thing, and I'm going to take this elephant back to my hometown, to my home where I found him. And it becomes a road trip movie, and he meets oddball characters along the way. He bonds with this elephant. I had fun watching this, Hannah. I had a good time.
I did not.
I didn't think you would. I knew you would not like this movie.
I kept thinking, we just saw Okja about a girl and her super pig.
Okja was better.
And now we have Popeye about a depressed middle-aged man and his elephant. And this one was so freaking slow, Charlie.
No.
It was slow. It's, a brilliant performance by the elephant, I'll give you that. But they spent every scene to me just felt very long. They spent way too much time. There's like the scene in the bar where he's helped out by a transvestite
prostitute.
Which is
one of the best scenes in the film.
It takes way too long. They're in there for too long. It might have been a crowd pleaser at Sundance, but I suspect that's because they were being very generous, that it just was this woman's debut film. And
you know what it is? It's the second half is better than the first half. When he connects it, when he finally, there's flashbacks, and when he connects the whole thing all together, yeah. You learn what happened.
Yeah.
It descends a level. It gets deeper. It's like, now I get it.
Yeah. When you finally also...
Because you don't understand his connection to this elephant. You don't get it.
Until you see him watching the Popeye cartoon, and you know that that was his escape when, as a kid, was watching these Popeye cartoons.
Oh, but not because of the name or anything, how he grew up with the elephant, and then what he did to the elephant to get
the
success in the world.
In the last 10 minutes, you learn why.
And it ties it all together.
It does, it was a long wait for that payoff of the last 10 minutes for me. And I just... Also, my biggest fear, and you see it in tiny print on the postcard you're holding about this film, this is not for children.
It says, please note, this movie is not suitable for children.
And so what do you see on that poster? You see a giant circus elephant and a guy with an umbrella walking down the street. If I was a kid and I saw that poster, I'd be like, let's go see this film with this great giant elephant.
No one's
going to
have that problem. This is playing in 5 cities total on one screen.
And there's a reason for that. And it's not rated. And so the reason I'm pointing this out is that there are some very mature scenes. and very mature themes.
Nobody would accidentally take their kid to Popeye.
I hope nobody. Not. But you never know. I'm just putting the warning out there. Not only will no parents go to take their kids to see Popeye, I don't think anybody's going to go find Popeye.
You would do your kid more harm taking them to Despicable Me 3.
No, I don't agree.
Because it's that bad.
No. Don't go sending anyone who is otherwise going to see Despicable Me 3 to Popeye, because that would be a huge mistake.
No, Popeye is a really good first film. It's not a blast. It's not supposed to be, but it's thoughtful. You can never go home again, Hannah. Never go home again.
It is very thoughtful, but it's slow, and I just don't think it's going to catch fire, that's for sure, but I'm glad you enjoyed it.
What if this was a Terrence Malick film and we were hearing the elephant's voiceover?
Then I would just shoot myself.
All right. Well, that really wraps up the most interesting and unique Cinema Clash episode ever, where out of the four movies we talked about, I liked each one of them better than Hannah.
Except for Girls Trip.
No, I liked it more than you did.
Yeah, you probably did. All right. But I did not... I didn't dislike...
No, I didn't think you disliked them.
Other than Popeye, which I just could have done without, easily have done without, I got something out of the other three that made it worth having seen.
But I am raving over the masterpiece of Dunkirk and heartily defending, right now, one of the top 10 best films of the year in Valerian.
Okay. You are so alone on that.
And I kind of, it feels exhilarating. Like, I will defend it. Come and attack me.
And I'm just all ready for that, because when we do our top 10, if that's still in your top 10, well, I'm
this
just
is still
going
the first,
seriously,
you know,
question.
7 months
still
of the year.
Still in the early part. But I do think there's going to be a divide over Dunkirk, in much the same way that there was a divide over La La Land.
A divide over Dunkirk. It's got 96% on that.
No, but so did La La Land. Had a very strong...
Did La La Land have a divide?
Yes.
Technically, so for 2 minutes, it won the Best Picture Oscar.
I know, but I have friends who don't understand why I was raving about La La Land, didn't get it, or just thought it was meh. They thought it was okay, they thought it was good, but they didn't understand what all the hubbub was about. And so I think it's going to be the same thing with Dunkirk, and I just happen to be in that camp that liked it enough, but would I expect everybody to really... jump on that bandwagon and embrace it the same way? No, I think this is actually going to be a tough watch for a lot of people, unless they happen to really know the story and catch it on the biggest screen possible.
It's not that. It's less hardcore than Saving Private Ryan.
It's not a hardcore. It has nothing to do with that, but Saving Private Ryan, you grasped the narrative and you knew which characters you were identifying with and rooting for.
I understand all this trepidation about, ooh, you might not know who someone is for 2 seconds.
For 2 seconds? They all looked alike for like an hour.
But you know, it's like one of the three.
But you knew it was one of the pilots, or you knew it was one of the kids in the hull of the ship. But I don't... it'll be interesting. It'll be interesting to see come award season. Without a doubt.
I hope they remember it.
Oh, I think, I mean, in Hans Zimmer, for score, you might as well just hand him the
freaking... Cinematography, score.
You might as well hand him the Oscar now, possibly. So, as a cinematic experience, absolutely, it's worth seeing in IMAX, or at least on a very, very, very large screen in 70mm. But if you're not into a non-linear type of very limited dialogue and narrative, then I think people aren't gonna get it.
All these qualifications are just needless and ridiculous. It's a standard film.
It's
I don't know
what standard film. It's
a, oh goodness. Well, I feel refreshed and reinvigorated by this episode. Like, I'm having fun at movies.
Reset.
Again.
We're resetting
like, I'm having good. So thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Cinema Clash. I'm Charlie Jewell.
I'm Hannah Buchdahl.
Thank you.
Take care.